Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Barely Backcountry Podcast. Today we got another guest on. We got Brandon Waddell on, who is the founder of Mountain Archery Fest, one of the biggest 3D shoot organizations out there. They offer everything from fun courses to competitive courses, to anything else you could want to go do on a 3D course. So definitely give this podcast a listen. We talk a lot about hunting, some of the changes that are happening in Colorado, and then the whole story behind how Mountain Archery Fest was created. So Brandon, thanks for coming on. Had a great time talking with you. Before I get you guys into that podcast, make sure you guys check out the podcast on social media. It's Barely_Backcountry_podcast on Instagram. And then my personal is C.Dillashaw. Make sure you guys give the podcast a like, a follow, a share, leave a review, all those good things. But without any further ado, I'll get you guys into the conversation with Brandon. All right, guys, welcome back to another episode of the Barely Backcountry Podcast. Today I got Brandon Waddell on, who is the founder of Mountain Archery Fest, and a hunter and all those good things. But Brandon, if you want to introduce yourself, we can get started.
Hello, this is Brandon Waddell, and I'm out here in Hesperus, Colorado, down the southwest corner there, and I'm founder and owner of Mountain Archery Fest, like you mentioned, and I really appreciate you having me on the show, Caleb. Thank you.
Absolutely, man. So I kind of want to go back to the beginning. I mean, obviously hunting appears to be a big part of your life. So where did that kind of start for you?
Well, you know, it was only about 15 years ago. I did not grow up in a hunting family. I grew up in a fishing family. You know, I had a good friend of mine, Tommy Romero. He came out to a property that I just purchased here in Colorado, and we had some good muleys on the property. And I ran into him at the barber shop, and he was talking about he had a tag in our unit, which is basically only about 10% public and not great. It used to be really good, but not anymore. And so anyway, I said, you know, I got some bucks, man. I said, why don't you come out to the house, you know, this weekend, and let's see if we can get one down. And he came out and found some success first thing in the morning. And then we were kind of screwing around. We got that deer cleaned up and got it put in his truck, and he's all, we're just talking, you know, about hunting and this and that. And I told him, he asked me if I'd ever bow hunted. And I said, no, I said, you know, I shot like fiberglass bows when I was in Boy Scouts and shit like that. But that was about the extent of my archery career thus far. And so, he says to me, he says, well, I got my bow right here. He says, what draw length are you? And I looked at him like, huh? You know, and he proceeded to pull out his bow. And so I got in behind that thing, and sure enough, man, it was a perfect fit. We're the same draw length. I could pull the poundage, no problem that he was pulling. And so he's like, all right, well, you know, the peep was a little bit off, but for the most part, we were pretty square. So at 20 yards, I started shooting this bow of his, and man, it was like, kind of an epiphany for me. Is, you know, I grew up riding Harleys and things like that, and there's only the two times the world could kind of spin without me, and that was when I was on my Harley or on my wife. And so so next thing I know, man, I'm shooting this bow and I'm just like so focused, and I'm like, he's even talking to me, and it's just kind of like wah, 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 right? And I'm just like focusing on this pin, and I was just, it enamored me. You know, that was it, dude. It was like, it was game on at that point. I, traded a 22 to a guy, a 22 rifle, this young kid that had a bow. Well, he was trying to get rid of it. And so I traded him for it, and I took it in a local shop at Goods for the Woods and met Eric, and he kind of got me lined out on this bow, and I started shooting. And I mean, within a month, I was like, okay, yeah, I want something better. So I went down, got another bow that was on consignment and picked it up. And then it wasn't a month later, you know, a good friend of mine, Dennis Howell, he called me, and Prime had sent him a couple bows. They were trying from Hoyt. And he wasn't real stoked. So he sold me a brand new Prime bow for $400. And it was game on, dude, from there. And I mean, that's kind of how I got into archery. That's kind of how I got into hunting. And then, you know, from there, I just had Dennis and Tommy and and Goods for the Woods. I shot in Winter League, and I just started honing my craft and learning as much as I could. And that's kind of how it all began.
That's awesome. What were some of those first bow setups? I know you said one was a prime, but what was that first bow you shot, and then some of those
Dude,
first bows that you owned?
I couldn't even tell you. I don't even remember what they were, dude. I mean, like, what that first one I got was like ancient technology, bro. I'll just give you that. I don't even remember. I think the second one I bought was an old Matthews. I think it was, gosh, I remember it had eyes on the limbs.
Okay, that was one of the monster bows, I think.
Yeah, I think it was a monster bow. Yeah, and I'll
Yeah.
tell and it was sweet, but it was like I didn't dig the valley and the back wall on it all that much, to be honest. And
Yeah, they were pretty aggressive bows. That was that whole thing for them on those monster bows.
that's right.
Yeah.
So it was like it was a little much for me,
Yeah.
and I was just like, okay, yeah, like this is jumpy and kind of crazy versus the last one I had. I just didn't feel real comfortable behind it, and that first prime bow I got was a Synergy,
Okay.
and I set it up. Gosh, let me think. What did I have on that Synergy? I think I had a Trophy Ridge sight, like a five Trophy Ridge on it. I had a drop away QAD. I had a tight spot on it. I remember I was shooting Hunter arrows, like that was the name of them.
Yeah.
Can't remember who made those.
Think
Anyway,
it was
I
Gold Tip.
think it was Gold Tip Hunters. Yeah, I
Yep.
think you're right. And I was shooting those like, right a little less than 400 grain. And that was kind of my first setup, and I killed my first buck with that bow. And then I ended up selling that bow to Tommy, who taught me how to shoot, because he was shooting the same, he'd had the same bow for 15 years, and
Yeah.
we were hunting. It was slow. It was slow. I don't even remember what it was either, but it was slow. And we were actually in the same unit a few years later, and we were hunting these muleys, and there was this muley at like 50 yards, and nice muley, and he's like, he draws up on this muley, I range it, I'm like 50 yards, and he's like, oh, he's dead. And dude, he sent that arrow, and that arrow took so long to get there that that buck just leisurely strolled right on out from in front of that arrow, man. And Tommy was so mad. And he was so mad. He was like, okay, it's time to get, I'm buying a new bow. I'm buying a new bow. He was so upset. He's like, this thing's slower and shit. And so I ended up selling him that. Gosh, and I went through bows like crazy for a little while. I mean, every year. But I ended up, for the most part, getting behind Bowtex mostly.
Okay.
They seemed to have a big value for me. I still have that first one I bought as a Prodigy. And
Okay.
I shot that bow for at the first year, and I had a great season that next year. I shot a bear, a muley buck, a muley doe, a bull, and a cow, all with that bow in one season. And
Wow.
I loved that bow. It's still in the family. I gave it to my oldest daughter. Because a couple years ago, when she really started shooting really well, it was one of those things where she became my prodigy.
There you
And
go.
so I gave her my prodigy. And she's still shooting it, and she's killed with it. I mean, that's just a fantastic bow, in my opinion. And so when I put that one kind of the back wall as a backup, because then I started realizing I needed a backup bow, because I started hearing
Yep.
all these horror stories of people. Like the day before season or 3 days into season, something happened to their bow and they couldn't get cables or strings or blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
And so I hung it up on the wall and just kind of kept it around. I'd shoot it during Winter League. And then I don't know, I bought an SS or, I
Yeah.
can't, there was a bunch of them in there that I went through every year. And I pretty much stayed with them until we brought on Pete until math started. And not to get too far ahead there, but yeah, that was kind of, you know, that was it, you know. And I mean, I became obsessed to the point of where I was learning anything and everything I could about archery, gearing out, going to ATA, you know. It was, it wasn't too long after, I guess, let's see, where are we at? Five. Yeah, it was probably about 4 or 5 years into hunting. I got my first buck 3 years after I started archery hunting, a nice big muley.
Tell me that story. How did your first hunt go and that first shot on?
Well, so it wasn't my first shot in that. So I hunted the same buck in the neighborhood I live in. Okay. We had 3 years of playing chess, me and this big boy. And when I moved into this property, I found him. And I called him the Monarch because he was just absolutely perfect side to side. And so the first time I hunted him, I was on a neighbor's piece. It was about 350 acres, but it was like a back corner of his property. And there's these hippie liberals that live like right across the fence line. And literally, dude, I'm like stalking these deer, crawling up the side of this mountain. And she comes jogging by on this other guy's property with her little dog and like stops. The little dog starts barking at me. I just lay there and don't move. And then she's like, hey, who are you? And I just turned around and looked at her, and I'm like, I'm a guy that's hunting over here. Can you keep going? And she's like, oh, it's you, Brandon. How are you? And it's just like, oh my God.
Oh, jeez.
And those bucks hung out for a few minutes. They got up, they did the stare deal. You know, and then they got a little uncomfortable, and then that was it. And then that same year, I put a couple stocks on that dude, and I had like a shot at like 60 yards, and I flung one, and I was shaking. I totally missed him. I shot low. And then the next year, I had a couple opportunities to work on him. All around, I mean, you know, I live out on what's called the dry side outside of Hesperus. And so we get some big bucks out there that eat well. And so I was on a different property hunting this buck and ended up putting a couple stocks on him in a week and just couldn't quite finish it. And then the best one was, though, is towards the end of the season there, I got him down in this little canyon. I could see him, and it was like I could do this toll stock. The wind was perfect. It was down where it was quiet for me, and I worked my way in on him, and I lost him. I didn't know where he went, and so I'm cruising up through this little valley gully thing, and I stopped behind this oak brush, and it's a big oak bush, you know, probably 20 feet around, 25 feet round, big, tall, about 8-10 foot tall, and I stopped there, and I'm just kind of chilling, and I'm like, I'm looking around, and I think he was here somewhere. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like looking around, and I'm making noise, and I'm looking around. And the next thing I know, he stands up. He was literally on the other side of that oak brush, bedded down. He stands up. We're staring at each other through this oak brush. And it's like, and I didn't know which way to go. Like,
yeah,
you know, I can't shoot through. And so I was like, best case scenario I thought in my head is I'm going to draw and I'm going to run around this thing and I'm going to hope for the best, right? And if he takes off running, hopefully he's going to give me the 40-yard turn look and I'm going to smoke him. And I went running around that bush and he ran around the bush. He didn't run away. That guy ran around the bush. He ran around the bush. And it was like we just kept looking at each other and he didn't know what I was. I didn't, you know, it was, we did this twice. And I did a full circle around this bush, and so did he. And then I finally make this last charge around the bush, and he just turns ass and tail and just up the hill straight away from me goes and never gives me a look back.
Oh, jeez.
And so that was the last time I seen him that year. And then the next year, well, let's rewind just a little bit. I was an ex-chef for a long time. And so me and my nephew Jacob, we used to do what was called a shot, caught, and trapped barbecue every year. And it originally started like the last weekend of August. Well, then we were doing it before I bought this property. And then when I started hunting, it was literally opening weekend of archery. Okay.
Okay.
So I would have friends out on Saturday morning, lots of people who had never eaten game. I mean, anywhere from, it started with like 10 to 15 people and ended up being about 100 people. Wow. by our 10th year. And we would cook an amazing spread of everything wild game you can think of. People basically bringing us stuff from the freezer and things cleaning out and this and that. And we would have a good time. And we'd always end up that night with a couple pints of moonshine, playing washers, and then sit around the fire.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that night we were hanging out, and I had planted like this little tiny food plot for my goats and whatnot, and these deer were pounding it. And yeah. So in the middle of the night, we went over and flashlighted that little thing, and he was there.
Nice.
And I was like, sweet, you know, like I'm gonna start hunting tomorrow. He's in the neighborhood, so I'll find him. Mm-hmm. And so the next day, I woke up, pounding headache, hungover like you wouldn't believe. Basically didn't move all morning, didn't go hunt. I had a little bit of time midday or late morning. I went down and I put a blind up down there by the pond and this plot deal. And I was like, okay, you know, set that up. I'll run the neighborhood, see if I can find him. Well, I got pretty tired, took a nap. My wife came home with Chinese, sat down, ate some Chinese with the kids. They were rowdy. I raised 9 kids. I had about 7 of them at home at that point. And I just needed to get out, right? Yeah. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to put my stuff on. I'm going to go sit in this blind, and I'm going to go basically take a nap. I had never gotten a picture of this guy in daylight, okay, yeah. On any camera around my house anyway. And so I was like, well, I'll go sit down there and see what happens. So I went down there and sat down, and I could hear my kids on the trampoline and Pam's kids on the 40 next door playing and raising hell. And I literally sat down on this bucket and leaned back, and I was out cold. I mean, passed right out. And I'm sitting there, you know, and you're passed out, but you kind of got, you do that pass out listen thing. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like you're not in a complete REM, but you're kind of, you can hear stuff. And all of a sudden I hear this boom, 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 and these deer jumped the fence. And so I kind of sat up and I was like, oh, okay, let's see who's here. And I lean over and I open up the blind, and I literally open the blind like 2 inches, and I'm like, holy shit, it's him. He was literally 3 yards from my blind. I mean, just standing right there. And I started freaking out, man. I mean, I started buck fevering like you wouldn't believe. I mean, everything in that blind sounded like it was amplified. Like, yeah. I was like, I moved my butt on the bucket. I moved my feet. I grabbed my bow. You know, it's like I didn't even have an arrow knocked. Nothing.
Yeah.
Okay. And I was just like, oh my goodness, he's right here. And it's like, and there's plenty of shooting light. I couldn't believe it. And I knocked an arrow, and I sat there for a minute, and I drew that synergy back. And I remember I was shooting G5 expandables, that 3-blade.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have that arrow and that hunter arrow in his rack even. And, dude, he walked out 20 yards in front of me, if that. And I smoked him, and he didn't go 40 yards and piled up. And I remember sticking my head out that blind, and these other 3 deer were there, and they were very respectable deer. And I just looked at them, and I was just like, I just shot your best friend. And I was dancing and having such a good time. And man, I'll tell you, that was it. And it was amazing. Like, I earned years of hunting that buck to get that opportunity. And just by chance, I mean, I would have never thought that I was going to kill that buck that night at all.
Yeah.
So, yep, that was my first kill with a bow. So yeah.
That's awesome. Has everything been archery for you, or have you picked up a rifle since you started hunting?
I've shot a couple cows with a rifle, but 98% of my hunting is all archery. Yeah, that's where my passion's at. That's what I love. You know, I'd been hunting elk for 3 years at that point, still hadn't killed one. It was that next year I shot my first bull, out of a tree stand, and, you know, and it's just been on ever since. I mean, I think at this point in 15 years, I've gotten 8 muleys and 3 bulls and 5 cows with my bow. And one bear at this point, one bobcat. Yep, that's it.
Nice.
Yep.
You mentioned shooting an elk. Kind of do some whitetail tactics on some elk.
Oh, absolutely. And I've never whitetail hunted ever, other than some coos deer this last August. I missed a boomer buck at 51 yards. They're tiny. They are so small. I thought I was a pretty good shot. But nope, not so much. I shot right below them at 51. But I was, once again, like, I got ice veins when it comes to elk. Ice veins. But when it comes to deer, dude, I'm a shaking mess. I highly encourage people who come west to, if you're, you know, early season, especially in a dry year, early season, and a tree stand over water is absolutely money. And I'm a firm believer of really any time of the season, but early and late, you know, pre-rut, post-rut, you know, now I hunt in a trophy line saddle, and I carry some lightweight sticks and a few screw-ins, and you know, that's a game changer. I mean, I can work the woods and I can find something I like, and I can climb and right there, and it's extremely successful. You know, it works really, really well. And a lot of elk don't really have much that they fear from above.
Yeah.
Okay. They don't look above 10 feet, basically.
Yeah.
You know, there's some places where they live down here in the lowlands where they deal with a little bit of mountain lions, but they, you know, so they're a little more aware, but still it's not a thing for them.
Definitely. That's interesting. Yeah, I've seen it become a little bit more popular, those whitetail tactics on elk, over the last few years, but are you pretty much exclusively doing that? Are you trying to do like calling also, or spot and stalk, or?
Yeah, I do a little bit. A little bit of everything. It just kind of depends on where we are. You know, some land that we hunt elk in aren't really conducive to a tree.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a lot of trees around. But even a good pinyon tree that's 15, 20 feet tall, you can get in a good pinyon tree and they won't even think twice looking in that tree.
Yeah.
But for the most part, you know, lowland, like New Mexico last year, Arizona, different places like that. I mean, depending on whether we're in the rim or up in the tree, in the pondos, you know, like we just kind of switch it up. You know, and sometimes I do a lot of ground wallow hunting as well. Sometimes I'm in with one of my kids or with someone else, and I'm not carrying a stand. So we'll call, we'll try to do some call-ins, but you know, if we can bed an elk with some cows near a water hole that we know they're going to probably come and visit in the evening, then it's ground blind central, man. I whip out a saw and we create an awesome ground blind right there. And, you know, we just try to get about 40 yards to 50 yards upwind of what we think is going to play that night. Mm-hmm. And set up, you know, you got to be with elk. You got to be a little bit more adaptive, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Same with bears. You know, you got to be a little bit more adaptive. We can't bait here. So you got to kind of know what you're dealing with there. I mean, you can, you know, it's, and if you set up a good tree stand on a watering hole and smoke an elk, you know, then you're in bear country for 3 days, right? You do a gutless method on that elk, And then when you're done, just slice that elk up, open his intestines and his stomach up, and let him start smelling. And within 3 days, you know, for 3 days, you're going to have the pick of a bear.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how we run that deal. So yeah, I highly suggest it to anybody to, you know, you got to kind of have a lot of tools in your belt when it comes to elk in the West, depending on what state you're in and what time of the season you're hunting.
Definitely. Yeah. Down here in Arizona, I mean, sitting water, you know, depending on the time of year, but sitting water is usually a pretty successful tactic, being, you know, a little bit drier climate down here. So definitely something to try out, but.
Yeah, I think water is really important in the beginning of the season because they're still in their summer pattern, right? And so until the woods get shook up a little bit, you know, I mean, I've had great success opening day on water out of a stand.
Yeah.
Because, and I don't make a peep. I go in there, I don't make a sound. No sound. You don't want to introduce anything out of the normal while they're still kind of in that summer pattern until some other hunters mess it up.
Yeah.
And that works really well.
Nice. Are you doing most of your hunting in Colorado now, or are you getting out of state much? Or
I just started getting out of state the last few years. Yeah, mostly in Colorado because it's like I don't have to go anywhere. Yeah. I mean, you know, I drive 45 minutes to a good honey hole, and I've already passed, you know, hundreds of elk.
Yeah.
And it's like, so, you know, I can hunt lion and bear and turkey and muleys and elk right here. I don't have to go anywhere. But since Colorado put CPW put Southwest Colorado into the draw for archery, I started going out of state a little bit more because our herds down here in the Southwest are pretty decimated.
Yeah.
They didn't do a real good job for years on cow tags, deprivation tags, and then plus our bears are out of control, our cats are out of control. We don't have spring bear anymore. Our quotas on cats are ridiculous. You know, so it was one of those things where every other year I'm not going to burn too much points trying to get an elk tag here locally. It used to be great because I could buy an over-the-counter tag and then I could hunt 5 different units.
Yep.
You know, heck, I could hunt 2 or 3 in the same day.
Yeah.
You know, and with you got enough pals kind of working around a little bit, we kind of figure out where they're playing and where they're not, and we would just converge.
Yeah.
And have a good time. But now you got to select your unit. You got to be a little more specific. You know, we used to have bull cow tags. Now it's just bull specific or cow specific. So, you know, I mean, we used to hunt bulls as much as we could. And then, you know, if we got down to the last few days, we'd kill if we couldn't get a bull to play.
Yeah.
But all that's changed. Yeah. So, I mean, now, you know, I've been doing a little bit more down in New Mexico. I drew a great tag in New Mexico last year, shot a great bull. And then I spent a lot of time in Arizona hunting deer the last couple of years, which is awesome. I haven't tried to apply for any elk in Arizona at this point. But I should be able to draw again in New Mexico next year. So I'm looking forward to that.
Nice.
And especially after what I learned down there last year or the year before, actually, you know, so yeah, and I'm getting more offers. I'm going to Kansas next year. I'm near Douglas to hunt whitetails finally for my first time.
Nice.
Looks like I'm actually going to go to Florida for a gator next year.
Wow.
And, but aside from that, you know, I'm not going to be doing a lot of archery hunting next year, to be honest. I'm probably going to be shooting some late rifle stuff for next year.
Okay.
And then going to Arizona and Mexico in January next year. So, in bow hunting that. Reason why is I picked up some great off-season work. Like I mentioned earlier, I was a chef for 15 years, and I started cooking this last year for Antler Canyon Outfitters. He's the gentleman that gives us a mule deer, coos deer hunt for Mountain Archery Fest every year.
Okay.
And, you know, through COVID, kind of had hunters in, they kind of did their thing, but he didn't have a lot of other people signing up at that point, but now he's got a great camp for coos deer in August. And this last year I went down and cooked for him and they were blown away. So he's asked me to come back for that. And then through that process, I have a lady in New Mexico that had me come and audition to be a chef for her. She's got a big, big lodge, brings in a lot of high flutin' tootin' people. And I'm going to be there for 3 months cooking all through archery. So I'm just going to build some points around and then hopefully come back and get some rifle meat tags done and then hone in on coos deer in Arizona and Mexico in January.
Awesome.
So, yeah, so that's kind of my plan moving forward.
Nice. That's cool. You mentioned a little bit, but things changing in Colorado within the last few years, and something has gone around on social media this week about them potentially getting rid of over-the-counter archery entirely. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's bullshit. Blunt statement. It's pretty funny. 3 years ago when they took all of our public comment, it just felt like we weren't heard. It just felt like a rigged election. You know what I mean? It just was a real bummer. Because they, in one sentence, they could say to us, oh, well, we have an 80% calving rate, but a 20% retention rate. So we're going to start cutting back on archery tags and the over-counter process to combat how much you guys are interrupting the rut. And it's like, you listen to what you just said. Like, we're not interrupting the rut if you're getting an 80% calving rate.
Yeah.
What you have is a predation problem that you're not able to hold due to predation. Because if you only got a 20% retention rate, it's in between the 80% and 20%. It's not in between the rut. You know what I'm saying? It's in between birth and onward. So it's like, and they're like, well, they're dropping calves that aren't alive. And I'm like, no, they're dropping calves with bears and cats following them around because they can smell that they're about to birth. And the minute they hit the ground, it's done deal.
Yeah.
And so, I don't like it. I kind of saw the writing on the wall the minute they took us to that. They did it down here first because we had the least amount of over-the-counter income versus the rest of the state and closer to Denver and Junction and all that, because that's mostly where people from the east go, is a little higher than where we're at, because it's easier access for them off the front range. They don't have to come over the range and get to the western slope to go in. Yeah. So the writing's been on the wall. I asked the commissioner years ago where this was leading, and he was just like, oh, we're just having a problem with the herds down there, so that's why. You can kind of read between the lines with these guys. So we're not really happy about it. We're hoping howl.org jumps on the bandwagon, of course. Big thing we're dealing with right this second, which is kind of interesting, is that this is all being thrown at us while we're in the final phases of trying to figure out this wolf agenda and this introductionary rules and all this stuff. So it's kind of like people are getting sidetracked here on this whole elk thing now when they need to be ultra focused on the wolf deal. Yeah. And that's just kind of how things work in our world these days. You know, when the real meat and potatoes are getting screwed with, they throw all this other smoke screens up and get most people, we're looking a different way, and then next thing you know, they pass laws and we're left without. And so it's a real bummer. In my opinion, it is going to really change the landscape for the most popular state in the country for elk. And we've got good, they've mismanaged some herds, but they just need to really look at within themselves and their biologists. I just think they're lazy, and I think that they're not doing their jobs the way they need to, and there's just so much more money in other parts of this that counteract us. So we'll see where it goes. I think everybody needs to be paying attention, because if it starts going down here, you can start kissing it goodbye. It's the same. It works like a tidal wave, right? From state to state to state. Everything does.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've seen it down in Arizona this year with the whole new quota system and them limiting tags for non-residents. Mm-hmm. And I'm not against it entirely. Like, I understand why they're doing it to, you know, hopefully manage herds a little bit better and all that stuff. But it'll be interesting to see what happens with that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you're still going to get – the thing is that we're still going to buy the tags.
Yeah.
We're still going to buy the tags and we're still going to go hunt. I mean, and it was kind of ridiculous. The first year that they did the – they put it in the draw down here, I drew in 71, 72, 73, 711. It's four units combined into one tag. Yeah. And I was so stoked that I drew it. And so then I went online to look at the numbers to see – how many tags were allocated and how many were drawn. And it blew me away that I was part of 379 people that drew that tag, but yet there was still 1,100 leftovers that were going to hit the secondary draw.
Yeah.
So what? Why did we do this? Why? Because they just wanted to know where we're all hunting. That's one of my theories. They wanted to know where we were hunting. They wanted to know, you know, because it's so easy from where we're at in Durango to hunt so many units that they wanted to start narrowing that down. And I think they should have just went on the backside and said, okay, it's a mandatory reporting.
Yeah.
That's all. Just mandatory report where you kill. And, you know, and then we know where you're at. And then we can account for our herds correctly. So, but, yeah, we'll see how it all shakes out. It's pretty much going to happen. They're taking comment in Gunnison on Wednesday. They're only taking three local places in the whole state for public comment. Otherwise, you can do it online.
Interesting. Yeah, I'll be interested to see what happens. I mean, I'm not entirely against it, but I'm not for it yet. I haven't researched it too much. I think for residents, I don't see a problem leaving it over the counter for residents. I wouldn't be against, you know, making it a draw for non-residents and just trying to cut back on maybe the number of people in the field, make it a little bit better experience for the people that have those tags. But I mean, you know more about it than I do living there. So I, like I said, I got to do more research on it before I say I'm for it or against it for sure, one way or the other, but it'll be interesting to see how it works out.
As you should. And that's how I'd encourage anybody that's listening. You know, you definitely should go and dig in and read it for yourself and put yourself in the shoes and figure out where you stand and then make your voice be heard. You know, because that's the most important piece, is we need to be heard. Regardless of whether we all agree or not, we need to be heard.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see what happens. Like I was saying, down here in Arizona, I heard something recently that if a unit meets its quota and they have to close down that unit 2 years in a row, it's then going to go to a draw unit and it'll no longer be over the counter. So,
yep, that's correct. And it's, you know, and that's kind of crazy too. Cause when you're looking at the outfitters and you're looking at the people that make a living on that situation, that's pretty sketch. I mean, you got people that want, you know, who's going to pay Antler Canyon Outfitter $5,000 for a coos deer hunt when halfway through their hunt, they could be told they're done.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't talked to any of the outfitters down here to see how they're combating it, but it seems to be like they're still successful. I mean, I'm sure they have multiple units that they're familiar with to kind of bounce around, but yeah, I mean, even if I'm sure if a lot of those units go to a draw, which I'm sure plenty of them will, I don't see them being very high point draws. I would imagine you could probably draw those tags with, you know, 0 to 2 points.
So yeah, yeah, at least every other year.
Yeah, it'll still be kind of over the counter in some way, where you could, you know, almost guarantee you'd have that tag. But I'll be interested to see how they do it. Like if they make it a draw for August, December, and January, or if it's just going to be one of those seasons, or how they break down that if when those units go to a draw.
Yeah, there's some scuttlebutt about you'd have to choose your month.
Yeah.
They'll allocate a certain amount of numbers per month, and you pick your month you want to hunt.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a horrible idea. Like I said, I don't see those tags being hard to draw regardless. So, but be interesting to see how it all shakes out. Working at a local archery shop, I get plenty of people that come in, and it seems like most people are upset with the whole thing, but I'm not entirely against it.
Well, change is always something that rubs people wrong, right? And then, of course, they want to see, they want to see it play out a little bit too. Some people are open-minded enough that even though they may not agree, they're willing to watch it play out and see if it actually works or doesn't work.
Yeah.
But, a lot of people, they just really enjoy the way it's been.
Yeah.
They've been successful. They've got the hunting they want. They've, there's flexibility in that tag. That's what I always liked about it for a couple of years is, man, I could go down there for 4, 5, 10, go back, come back down. I could bounce back and forth without any worry that I had to shoot the first thing that I see.
Yeah.
Because quota might end.
Yeah.
In this last year in August, we got, we're in the unit I was in, I don't think we got but about 15 days and the muleys were done.
Yeah.
And then it was coos deer left, and they went. They made it pretty much. They made it a while.
Yeah.
But that's just because they're a much harder animal.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Yeah.
But I didn't buy a tag for 23 in Arizona. I just missed out kind of to a degree, and I just wasn't sure how much I was going to be able to invest in the time.
Yeah.
January used to be kind of slow for me, but now it's the heart of me ramping up math to get ready for show season. And and then of course I wasn't sure if I was going to get to hunt much because I was going to be cooking so much this in the off season this fall, so I just opted to plan a little bit more ahead and go for that January 24 gig, and we'll see how it shakes down.
Awesome, man. Well, you mentioned Mountain Archery Fest there. Kind of tell me about that whole story, how it came to be, where the idea came from, and how you got that business, up and running.
Well, I had a podcast for about 3 years called Wilderness Attitude, and I was really highly into the archery industry with it, and a lot of recordings at Western Hunt and the initial scent booth and with HHA Sports at ATA. And I kind of got into the world a little deeper through that. And so through that, I had actually met Sean DeGray, the owner of Total Archery Challenge.
Yeah.
And me and Matt Howell, who goes by Muley Matt on Instagram, we had talked to him about bringing TAC to Purgatory, Colorado, because he didn't have a Colorado event at that time. And it was kind of a him and haw conversation. It really didn't go anywhere, but we knew this mountain would be awesome for it. And then after going to a couple of events in Utah, I was just like, this is like a sausage fest, man. There's no women here. There's no kids here. And a family man of nine, and whatnot. I just was kind of like, and I wasn't really in the cool kids club either. So it was kind of like, it was fun. Don't get me wrong. I enjoyed it. But I just came home and I just kept thinking about Purgatory, and I just kept thinking about him saying no. And I just kept thinking about, this idea, and I just kept pushing it down like, not your gig, not going to happen. But then I got this phone call, in December, 5 years ago, from a gentleman. His name is Gary, and he had this idea of starting Mountain Archery Fest, and it was kind of his idea in all reality. And he got a hold of me, and I was going up to a Donnie Vincent film in Denver, and he came from Utah. I told him, we just mentioned in passing that I was going there, and he's like, well, I'll get in touch with you when you get back. Mm-hmm. Well, I showed up at this film and he was there, and he was like, I came here to talk to you. He goes, look, I've called around. I've talked to people. I know you help Kenton with Train to Hunt, and I know you help Pope and Young do events and shoots and obviously you know how to set mountain 3D and this and that. And he's like, I want to hire you to be my mountain manager and set all these courses, and I'll do all the sponsorships, I'll do all this and that, and I'll find the resorts and you be my right hand man. And I kind of beat it around a little bit, and I hemmed and hawed on it, talked to my wife, and we thought, okay, let's go down this road a little bit further and a little bit deeper, and let's see what he's talking financially. Let's see where we're at and kind of go down that. And so, so we met and we started working on this project, and, you know, I knew a lot of great people in the industry. So I did a handshake on $60,000 worth of Kirsch targets, without any deposit, got them on a boat, got them coming from Austria, and started working on some other aspects of stuff that I needed. And it wasn't about a month into it, my partner Gary, he had both of his knees done. Mm-hmm. And within about a month after that, we were at Pope and Young convention, and he came to me and told me he had to leave, that he was going to have to give me the opportunity and he was going to have to step away. He needed to get some help and he needed to save his marriage and he needed to kind of step back and get things right for himself and his family. So at that point I went back to my wife and I was like, okay, what do I do now? You know, like, this isn't really my forte. It isn't really, you know, I've never done this before in a sense. And, you know, and there was some conversation about, well, you know, I ran a potable restroom company for 7 years and did big special events. I did balloon rallies and big concerts and motorcycle rallies and Jeep fests and concerts. And, you know, and so I had some idea about how big events were ran. As a chef, I catered some big events, and I had $60,000 worth of targets on the ocean. and so we talked it over, and I was like, okay, that's it. I'm going to do it, you know, and stepped into that space, and he signed everything over to me. And then from there, I just started working as hard as I could on the dream that I had kind of in the back of my mind. To have an event that was all inclusive, all disciplines, all ages, all skill levels, and something that, you know, just really resonated with my life and what that meant. You know, and I just started hitting all these people who I had been sponsors with and all this stuff and just really working my connections. And the next thing I know, here I was getting ready to have a shoot. We had four locations that we'd originally started with. We were going to do the four corner states, and Arizona and New Mexico fell apart. Okay. And I had Purgatory and Brian Head Ski Resort in South Utah. And then 29 days before my event in Utah, they called me and told me they were pulling the contract due to snow and going to reschedule with me for later in the summer. And so with that, it was like, I got a hold of Eagle Point, and the next thing you know, we held an event 29 days later on that mountain. And then came to Purgatory and had an event here. And it was extremely well received. You know, it was really awesome to start and to see the support that poured in. It was just absolutely amazing. And we from there, I've never looked back, man. And, you know, we just won an event that a little bit more low key, not so much Hollywood. Not, you know, more family inclusive. We offer camping on site. You know, we offer courses that from our Pope and Young world record course, which was something that I dreamed up with and then went to Philip Kirsch and George Verha, who is a foam expert. And I went to them and said, hey, I want to build this course. I want to take the world record antlers. I want to have them recreated. And I want to figure out how to mount them on foam. And they were like, minds blown. And they were like, And it was one of those things where as I researched it, no one had ever done such a thing.
Yeah.
And so I went back to Pope and Young and got things worked out, and we ended up creating the 29 North American Slam world record course by the records held by Pope and Young. And it's our beginner course, because a testament to the hunters, there's not a shot over 52 yards in any of the world records.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
That's cool. So are the shots the actual distance that were taken on that animal?
Yes.
That's cool.
This distance, angle, the whole thing, everything that we can recreate as close as possible.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, I've seen those. Obviously, I mean, your Mountain Archery Fest has blown up over the last few years. And it's, you know, I've seen it quite a bit on social media, and that Pope and Young course is one that I see quite a bit. I haven't been able to make it out to an event yet, but it's definitely on the list. Yeah, and that's a pretty cool course that you got there.
Yeah, we're going to definitely change that for you this year for sure. I'll have you up, no doubt. And, you know, it's one of those things for us that as we started to grow, I mean, we've doubled every year. We've added shoots every. We went from 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 to 7. You know, our attendance continues to grow and grow. You know, our return attendance is upwards of 90%. You know, and we're really happy, man. I'll tell you. You know, the crew, my board, my crew that we've created, is top notch. These guys, that my road crew and setup crew, like if you come to an event year after year, mm-hmm. the targets are not in the same place.
Yeah. Okay.
They're moved around. They're new shots. We recreate the mountain every year. You know, we take a lot of pride in changing and retheming our courses and doing new things and kind of growing with the industry on some stuff. And, you know, and we have 5 courses of 25 targets, 29 on the Pope and Young, which actually this year, the Pope and Young world record course is going to get reduced a little bit. Pope and Young's not coming back to sponsor that course any longer. So it's just going to be the MAF world record course. So we're going to actually be adding some exotics to it.
Wow.
So after it being on the road for 4 years, we're going to make it a world record course where we're going to have some cool stuff from around the world on it.
That's cool.
So stuff you've never seen, stuff you've never shot. And that's the cool thing about our event also is that we use almost exclusively Kirsch hunting targets. And so it's stuff that most people have never seen ever before.
That's cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've looked at those. I've noticed that, you know, you guys have different targets because, I'm used to seeing, you know, a Delta McKenzie or a Reinhardt or something like that. But, mm-hmm. yeah, you guys have different targets than everybody else, which is cool to see.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that was part of my plan. And it's also, you know, a cool thing in our competition, our Mountain Madness comp. It's really unique because a lot of these guys that show up and are pretty hot to trot, they have never seen these targets. And the interesting thing I always tell them in the beginning of our conversation is that in our intro meeting on at the shoot is that in Austria, they don't archery hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they can put the rings wherever they want.
Yeah.
So they're always a little bit back or a little bit forward or a little high. You know, they're not, as an IBO setup target, they're not right in the pocket where you expect them to be. So you really got to look. You really got to pay attention. And you have to ultra focus because a lot of people have told me they just gravitate to the pocket. It's so hard for them to not do it and actually shoot the rings. So, so it's an interesting, there are interesting targets. We do have some Reinhardts on the mountain, obviously to fulfill our Pope and Young course.
Yeah.
But, for the most part, it's 95% Kirsch targets.
Nice. Talk me through that, like competitive shoot. Cause competitive archery is something that I'm diving into kind of head first this year. I've just set up my first target bow less than a month ago. I've been doing a lot of indoor stuff recently, and we'll be doing some starting our like more local 3D series and all that here in the next few weeks. So the competitive side definitely interests me as far as what you're doing there.
Yeah, so the Mountain Madness comp is on Saturday. It's only a one-day, one-course shoot. And then we do a stand-up shoot-off at the end of the afternoon in front of everyone in Vendor Village. So it's pretty cool. You know, it's we have plenty of we do adult pro, men's or women's adult hunter, young adult, youth division, Cubs division, 10 and under. You know, so we have a little bit for everybody, even masters 60 over. This last year, we give cash prizes for first through third and some awesome one-off math medals that we do. And we do a shoot-off for the top five, top three get awarded. So there can always be a change up there. And cash prizes are always awarded to a full field. The full field consists of six shooters per class. Most of our shoots, the hunter division is obviously the most filled. And, I mean, we give away upwards of $500 to $600 to first place, $350 to second, $200 to third. First place walks away with a morale target as well. You know, it's a good time because we have a great course set up for them. And then when they're all done, like I say, we do the shoot off, and that's in front of everybody and anybody. And that's a lot of people have never done that. A lot of people do these shoots and they just, they're first and they win and that's it. It's over. But standing up there next to your peers in the top five and shooting at three targets is pretty nerve wracking to some people. And it really builds what I think is some great character. And I mean, even when you get those Cubs up there shooting and the youth division shooting next to each other, I mean, it's on. It's serious time up there. And I try to make fun of it and have a good time with it. But these, you know, most of these shooters are pretty in tune. But something that we're in our Mountain Madness comp is we have been developing for the last year or two what we consider a par system. Okay. So our courses will have a par built into them. So when you go to shoot those courses, you'll have descriptions of those courses, shortest shot, longest shot, and then some pars that kind of go with it to kind of give you an idea of how hard that course is, because every mountain that we set up is all a little bit different. We always thought that, the carbon course is always it's just the carbon course. It's long shots. It's this and that. And, you know, sending carbon through the air, shortest one to 80 yards, longest is 150. Then we go to our like initial ascent course, and it's primarily our hunting course. So we set up really realistic hunting scenarios. It's something that I take a lot of pride in, stuff that I'm good at, stuff I'm working on, shooting across cambers, feet down, feet up, kneeling, sitting, crawling up and shooting, just all these different types of hunting scenarios and hunting shots, narrower keyways. You have to be aware of branches in the way, things like that. And then for like our intermediate course, we just always thought that we were setting these all the same, but every mountain creates these different scenarios and these different things that we have to work through, whether they're environmental or physical or the landscape or maybe the target or the backdrop. And so I got this guy I've been working with, and he's killing it. This new parring system that we're going to kind of do is really cool, and that'll be part of our Mountain Madness to a degree this year. It's going to be different for people to wrap their minds around a little bit, but not that you're going to have a par established before you shoot the Mountain Madness course, but you're going to work through this course either through a paper target or a paper scorecard or an online scorecard, okay? But what's cool is it's going to tell you that this shot is a par this based on these 12 parameters.
Okay.
And so we're just kind of throwing it out there this year to kind of see how people accept it and see how it kind of works and see how we've been talking about it on paper for a while, and we think it's going to really, not necessarily this year, but the next year when we go static across an app, where we're going to have shoots in the east, shoots in the west that could be happening on the same weekend, and with a end of the year Mountain Madness shoot off, okay, where if you're in the points, you'll get invited. And then there's also some wild card opportunities there too in 24 that we're working on. So we'll have our last event in 24. We'll have another mountain, and it's going to end up being not just a 1 day shoot at that last one. It's going to be a 3 day comp. And so people from all over the country will be invited to that 3 day comp. And the cool part is that you'll have an option of shooting courses in the east or courses in the west. And of course those courses and those mountains are going to have parring to them. Well, if you need more points, you may have to step out of your comfort zone and go shoot a parred course that will give you more points for a win. See? Okay. So this is a topic for a whole nother conversation, really, because it's really in depth and it's really intricate. But we've got this set up to whether it's on the app or on a paper scorecard, to where at how you fill your stuff out. A lot of times comps take a long time at the end to rally scores and get things spit out so that you can continue the shoot off. But what we're using, some different Scantron systems like you used to take tests in high school and in junior high, where you fill in the number two pencil in the dot. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's the same concept. You'll walk up, you'll put your scorecard in the scanner, it'll zip it through, and it'll spit it out to us, and it'll format you.
Huh. That's cool.
So we're really, that's one of the places where I really wanted to raise the bar at math was in the competition side, because I just see what we could do with this nationwide scenario. And make it a lot of fun. You could be, let's say for instance, next year, not in 23, but in 24, you could be shooting in at Camp Freedom in Pennsylvania. Uh-huh. And on the same weekend, you could be shooting Snowball, Arizona. Okay. Yeah. And let's say that you're in the top 10 nationally. Okay.
Yep.
You could be watching live on your app what's happening while you're shooting in Arizona.
Wow.
And vice versa. So you want to talk about pressure?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. It's really cool stuff that we've been working on. We've been working with Hunt League. There's an app called Hunt League, and you can look it up on Android or on your iPhone. And currently right now, what you're only going to find is you're going to find this great Hunt League where he has competitions. You register yourself as a shooter, a hunter. You get scored based on what you've killed in your life, how long you've been shooting, and you get put into a Hunt League. And in that Hunt League, depending on how well you hunt this year, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, and you earn points for scouting, you earn points for this and that, all these different things, okay? But the packages that he's dropping at the end of the year, if you win that league, is 10 grand.
Dang.
Worth of gear and cool stuff. So, like, Jared's done a great job at creating that. You guys should be on the lookout for that. Anybody that's listening, it's pretty awesome. And that's going to be something that we're integrating as well, but we're doing a 3D league.
That's cool. That's awesome. So in those pro classes, are guys bringing like full-blown target rigs, or is it still like a hunting bow type shoot?
No, adult pro is definitely shoot what you bring.
Okay.
Okay. So shoot any setup. Then your men's and women's hunter, it's a max 12-inch stabilizer front, and you can have a sidebar of any size.
Okay.
Fixed pins or movable sights, no magnifiers. So I shoot a single pin, so therefore this is my shoot. So movable sights are in the hunter division. I don't do an outlaw class. It's in the hunter. It must be a hunting setup. You can't fool me and you can't fool my guy. I'll be able to tell if it's a hunting rig or not. Yeah. And then of course we have men's and women's traditional, no pins. Youth 11 through 14 and Cubs 10 and under, max 12 inch front, no scopes. Men's and women open, shoot what you bring. The only difference between men's and women open and pro division is your payout. So your pro division's 150 and the rest of your adult divisions are $100. Okay. Young adult 15 to 17, max 12, fixed pins, movable sights, no magnifier, hunting setup, and then masters is shoot what you bring.
Nice. Good to know. Yeah, that definitely that definitely excites me. And that whole kind of, I don't know if series is the right word, or but that whole thing you're talking about doing in 2024, that definitely piques my interest and something I'm going to try to compete and hopefully make the finals. And you mentioned Snowball Arizona. Is that on the list, or is that just something you were throwing out there?
It's been on the list, but it doesn't look like it'll manifest. They're tough to work with. They don't want to give us the whole mountain. They want to give us the weak part of the mountain, if you will. They don't want to give us, they want to give us the other lift. You know, it's like, no, if I'm giving you this amount of money, it's my mountain. Yeah. And they're like, no, you can give us all that money and we're still going to be open to the public and they're getting the best chair. And it's like, yeah, no. Yeah. So we have entertained doing the 4th of July shoot there at, what's the other, not Snowball, what's the Sunrise. We've beat that around. They've approached us a couple times. We can't seem to find an agreement there either. So I don't know where we'll end up in Arizona at this point. It's kind of, there's not a whole lot to choose from there, but you know, I'm not stuck on properties that have chairlifts or ski resorts. So if anybody's listening and they got, you know, a killer property in Arizona that, that could meet our needs, we're open to that. Yeah. Like our Soldier Hollow event up near Salt Lake in Heber City, that's at the old Soldier Hollow is the old 2002 Winter Olympic grounds, and that's a walk out walk in mountain for us, and it's awesome. Our first two events of the year, Kingston Downs in Rome, Georgia, that's a walk out walk back course, and so is Camp Freedom in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I mean, I looked at Montage Ski Resort there in Scranton. You know, it was just too tight to do what we wanted. And Camp Freedom, everything that they stand for is everything we stand for. And the partnership just seems like a complete no-brainer. And with 26 miles of two-track, we got a lot of room to put some awesome shoots together there. So our first three are without lifts, but then Purgatory, Eagle Point, Antelope Butte, and Blacktail, they're all on ski resorts. And, like I say, you know, to find a ski resort in every state or where I want to be with that's the size that we need to hold five courses, you know, is pretty impossible.
Yeah.
And one of our courses that we do is the Track Action Mobility course. And that's a pretty special course to me these days. We started that last year. It triples as a kids course and comp course. Okay. But it is adaptable, and we even have track action chairs at some of these events where you can come and if you've never used a track action chair and you're disabled, and it doesn't mean you have to be military or not, it's open to anybody. But these track action chairs are like those, they're like those wheelchairs with they have tanks on tracks on the sides of them.
Yep.
And we have the only course that we know of in the United States where they can shoot that, they can go to each target and pull their own arrows if they can't and see their own shot. A lot of these places, they set up courses where they cruise on these manicured places and they shoot and everybody goes up to the target except for them.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a drag.
Yeah.
But a good friend that I met a few years ago at a shoot in Utah came wheeling up to me in a wheelchair. I saw him coming across the courtyard from 50 yards, man. He has eyes on me, and he was bringing it. And he wheeled up next to me, and his name is Brock. Brock Carter. And he wheeled up to me, and he looked at me, and he says, "You ever thought about making a course for people like me?" And I looked at him, and I said, "I don't understand. What do you mean, people like me?" And he just looked at me like, seriously? So we had a little laugh, and I kneeled down next to him, and I said, "Yeah, it has crossed my mind." I said, "But I was always kind of always been kind of intimidated to do it. You know, I just don't know enough about your world, you know, and what your needs are." And he's like, "Well, I'm your guy. I'm going to teach you. I'm going to show you. And we're going to make this happen. And I'll be damned if we didn't." Now we're going into our second year this year, man. We're giving away an all expenses paid mule deer hunt in New Mexico and a a new chair, a brand new Axis track chair. It's a $20,000 chair, custom one-off pearl paint job, all sorts of cool stuff added to it from our sponsors. And we're going to give that away to someone needy this year. Someone who, not, I shouldn't say needy, to someone in need, someone who it could change their life. Right. And that's going to be awesome because you can let people know about it and they can go online and they can submit their entry. NeuroWorks out of Utah is going to vet us down to our top 12. And then Mountain Archery Fest is going to vet it down to 3. And then Track Action Mobility is going to pick our finalist.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I've never had the thought that, you know, those people couldn't go and pull their own arrows. Like, I've seen events do that where, you know, they do it for disabled veterans and all that. But I've never, the thought that they couldn't go and pull their own arrows has never crossed my mind. So that's awesome that you guys do that.
When we first started building that course, it was like we were like manicuring these things, right? And then it was like by our third or fourth course, we're like, oh no, that chair can go right over that 6-inch log. We ain't cutting it out.
Yeah.
You know, we make this and we make the course to where it's like they got to go. This chair earns it. Yeah. Like, and these people get to come see what these chairs are capable of doing.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, dude, there wasn't an event one last year, Caleb, that I didn't ball my brains out.
Really?
Watching some of these people. We had this guy last year that came to Soldier Hollow. His family got word of the deal through Mountain Physio. Mountain Physio reached out to him and said, hey, we got this course. I think you should bring your husband. He was interested. He was an archery hunter before. He's been in a bad place, bad accident. He's tried to commit suicide 3 times. Was just in a bad place. Was very angry, very upset. Just felt like life had just really dealt him a bad deck, you know. And he came up to that event, and he was pretty standoffish, pretty short. You could tell he was just aggravated, like he wasn't sure he wanted to be there. He was getting attention. He was getting attention he didn't want. Yeah. And his wife and his daughter were there, and another guy and him set out with the chairs, and the family followed, and you know, we had a 25 target set up, and literally by the 10th target, this guy was gleaming and smiling and hooting and hollering. He was get every shot he made was getting better and better and better. And by the time we were done, by the time they were getting close to being done with that course, I caught up with them all. And I was talking to the wife and the daughter. And I walked up on them and they were bawling. I mean, bawling uncontrollably out of happiness.
Yeah.
Because it had been 3 years, they said, since they'd seen him even smile.
Wow.
And he left there and he's now doing really well, doing league. He's getting tags. He's going back out in the woods. He got himself a track action chair. He's regained his life and his purpose, his why. And, you know, all because Brock wheeled up to me and said, you're my guy to help me do this. Wow. And, dude, whew, heavy,
yeah.
Heavy, you know, I mean, and watching that stuff change people's lives is absolutely magnificent.
Yeah.
And it's just given everything I do a whole nother level of purpose. I mean, you know, I started because I handshake on targets. I didn't really know what I was getting myself into. But after the first couple of years, I started realizing that there was a big need for this and that there was lots of people who had been to TAC, who enjoy TAC, but want something different. You know, and there's tons of people that get turned away every year at shoots. And, you know, I just felt like there was a need. And then I started fulfilling a need, and then it started fulfilling things in me.
Yeah.
And changing me. And then I started realizing how much this brings to my heart and how much I enjoy doing these shoots and watching families together and dads with their daughters and women coming out on their own to do, you know, women's clinics with Courtney, and people coming out to hone their craft and get better with, you know, with some clinics we do with Ethan and seminars. And, you know, and then we have a great Friday night cornhole tournament, which everybody enjoys and has a great time, and stories and s'mores with, you know, some key speakers on Friday, and then the comp, and, you know, and watching people grow in that comp, and just, you know, it's just the most amazing place to be. And I couldn't think of anything else I want to do with my life.
Yeah.
You know, and it all started with Tommy Romero handing me that bow.
Awesome. That is cool. Well, I can't think of a better way to wrap summed it up all there and
brought everything to a close,
going all the way back to where we started this podcast. So,
yep, that was exactly.
That was a great conversation. I think this is probably my favorite podcast I've ever done. I think we had a great conversation, covered it all. But before I let you go, tell me, one, I want to know where people can find Mountain Archery Fest, how they can get to an event, how they can find you, all those good things.
You bet. I mean, you can find us at www.mountainarcheryfest.com. That's our website. Go on there, check out our event locations. We have tons of information on that website. It should take you 20 minutes to go through it to read everything that we do and everything that we offer, and all the locations that we have. Like I mentioned, Rome, Georgia, Scranton, Pennsylvania, Midway, Utah, Durango, Colorado, Beaver, Utah, Shell, Wyoming, and Lakeside, Montana. And then from there, you can find us at Mountain Archery Fest on Instagram and Facebook. And then if you want to kind of get some behind the scenes scuttlebutt, you can follow me at Brandon Waddell _ on Instagram. I throw a few nuggets in there every now and then to kind of keep people interested. The event director's life, if you will. This time of year, it's a little bit boring, but it's getting ready to take off next week. I'll be in the country. Doing a lot of work. And so if you're in Utah, we're going to Western Hunt Expo. Then if you're in Pennsylvania, we're going to the Great American Outdoor Show. And then we're going to be in Nashville for 2 weeks with the National Wild Turkey Federation. And then we will be setting up our world record course for SCI. So if you're around Nashville, you can come and check out our world record course up at the Nashville Gun Club. We'll be there for 3 days. You know, and aside from that, feel free on the website to email us any questions. DM me at any time. We'll get anything answered for you guys that are listening. And we just really look forward to seeing as many of you as we can this summer, and give us that opportunity to show you who we are. And I'm sure you won't be disappointed.
Definitely. Can people sign up for the events right now, or the sign-ups live?
Yep. Registration is open for everything except for Kingston Downs in Georgia.
Okay.
We're about, I'd say in the next 2 days, it'll open. I just had a couple things on that contract we've been working through, and we're going to be good to go.
Nice. Do those events usually sell out? Do people need to sign up soon?
They do need to sign up soon if you want good shooting times. Do we sell out? Not at this point, but I can tell you this year, most of our stuff that's open other than Pennsylvania, the first couple hours are gone.
Okay.
So definitely. And then just real quick on registering, pricing wise, you're basically looking at $75, $95, $115 based on a 1 day, 2 day, or 3 day pass.
Okay. And then same entry fees if you want to shoot competitive or for fun?
So no, the competitive entry is completely kind of separate because we do cash payouts, right? So all that is separate. My best suggestion is if you do want to shoot the comp and you want to come do more, sign up for Friday for recreation, competition Saturday, and then recreation on Sunday. Okay. That's the best way to go about it. If you want to shoot all 3 days and be able to shoot every course we've got. And we do have another awesome opportunity. We have a stay and play package, which is a glamping stay and play package. We've got these awesome Davis tents. We set up four cots inside these tents. We set you up cots and climate pads, and you can, based on your package, whether it's $500, $550, or $600, all that changes is the type of pad that you get to take home.
Okay.
Okay. You get 4 3-day math passes. You get four cots, four climate seating pads, dinner for four on Friday and Saturday, lunch for four Friday, Saturday, Sunday, $50 in novelty shots per person, $50 in math merchandise, four entries to cornhole, entry into Saturday night social event, and a 30-minute massage for each person from, total mind blank. So the best part is that, you know, you can reserve these, get them done. So it's per person. So like $500 per person, and you get all that included. It's literally on a 4-person tent setup for $2,000. It's a $2,740 value. So you save $740.
Awesome. Yeah. Sounds like an awesome way to go if you can get the whole week in there.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
It's the way to do it.
Definitely something for people to look into. Awesome, Brandon. Well, before I let you go, a question I try to ask every guest before we close up is for a book recommendation. I was a horrible host and forgot to warn you about that at the beginning, so catching you off guard about that a little bit here. But is there a book that you want to recommend to people?
So I'm reading a book right now. It's called The Ultimate Secrets of Total Self-Confidence by Dr. Robert Anthony.
Awesome.
And it's an older book, but it's a great book. You'll learn how to contact your creative imagination and use it to kind of get what you want. It'll help you clear your mind of fear, worry, and guilt, and how the law of mental magnetism kind of affects you, right? And then another cool thing I'm seeing is it really best ways to communicate with others. And so I just find it a book that works all the way around, from your career, your family life, your love, your financial situations, your mental and physical health, and just really your day-to-day happiness to have a little bit more control. So yeah, totally recommend it. Killer book.
Awesome, Brandon. Well, anything else we want to touch on before I let you go?
Nah, man. Nah, I think we've been on here plenty. You know, I only let you have about 20 words in this whole podcast. And
no, I love
so it. Let's call it a good one and let's put it in the books.
Do it. All right, man. Brandon, thank you so much for coming on. I'll talk to you later.
Caleb, thank you, sir. Have a great one.
You too.
Bye. All right, bye.
All right, guys. I hope you guys enjoyed that podcast with Brandon Wandell. Brandon, if you're listening, thanks again for coming on. Hopefully I can make it out to an archery fest sometime pretty soon this year. Again, if you guys want to check out the podcast on social media, it's barely_backcountry_podcast on Instagram. And then my personal is c.dillashaw. Make sure you guys check those out. Again, give the podcast a like, a follow, a share, leave a review, all those good things. But that covers it for this week. Thank you guys so much for listening. I'll see you guys next week.